I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guest today is Stephen Lyman, who is known as a leading shochu expert and joined me twice to talk about shochu on episodes 23 and 109. And he moved to Japan last year and now lives in the Mecca of shochu, Fukuoka Prefecture in Japan. And Stephen recently published a very interesting book titled The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. And also he now has a cool shochu bar in Fukuoka. So today we'll discuss his new life in Japan, his new book and his new bar, and Japanese drink culture that he deeply observes as a resident of Japan now, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about the topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Stephen Lyman. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, very exciting to have you back all the way from Japan. So first of all, for listeners who have not listened to the previous episodes, tell us about your background briefly.
So I'm actually a medical researcher. that's my main occupation. And I discovered shochu, I guess going even further back, I discovered izakaya in New York shortly after I moved here in 2002. And I didn't really know what an izakaya was. I just knew there was a Japanese restaurant that served more than sushi. And then eventually I figured it out. And one night at an izakaya, I discovered shochu. And the waitress described it as Japanese vodka, which I'm not a vodka fan. I'll be honest. It's just too clean and light. And it just doesn't taste like much. And I was more of a whiskey drinker, wine drinker. But shochu was really interesting to me because you could taste the original ingredient. A barley shochu generally tastes like barley, and a sweet potato shochu tastes like sweet potato, and a rice shochu tastes like rice. It was really interesting to find a drink that in many ways reminds me more of beer or wine than it does of a spirit. And then as I got to drink it and explore it more, I started a website, kampai.us, which hasn't been updated recently because it's undergoing a renovation. And hopefully we'll have a relaunch soon. And that became my entryway into the food and drinks world in New York and then also in Japan. And I started to meet the makers when they'd come here for PR visits. And through that, I ended up going to Kyushu for the first time. So Kyushu is essentially where virtually all shochu in Japan is made. More than 90% of it's made in Kyushu. Fukuoka's in northern Kyushu. And I just fell in love with the area and began working every year in a distillery in Kagoshima in southern Kyushu to learn how to make it and learn more about it. And as I went that deep, I just became obsessed. And it really has changed my life in ways that I never would have guessed when I walked into that izakaya about 12 years ago.
You never know. So, you've been working as a kind of a shochu ambassador for Japanese Shochu Association.
That's right. I was, when I was in New York, I was working as a consultant for the Japanese Sake and Shochu Makers Association. That ended when I decided to move to Japan, but I still work closely with them and with JETRO, the Japanese External Trade Organization. And in, I believe it was 2015... It might have been 2016, I apologize. I was named a Shochu Ambassador by the Cool Japan Project. And subsequent to that, Christopher Pellegrini also received that designation. But as far as I know, we're the only two foreigners who have been designated as official Shochu Ambassadors.
Oh, that's really bravo, because I think there are many sake experts now. I mean, thanks to John Gontner, who's been teaching all these experts in English. But I think there are only very few, including you and Christopher, who really leads the trend of shochu. That's really amazing drink. Yeah. So before the show, we were talking how I feel so much better drinking shochu instead of other, you know, alcoholic beverages. So, yeah, I really think there's a big future for shochu.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
The health benefit that you talk about, it's so there's a couple of reasons, I think. One is the fact that it's distilled. There's no residual sugars. And you're, again, I'm getting into my medical research life here, but with no residual sugars, your liver has a hard time processing sugar and alcohol simultaneously. And that's where a lot of the hangover symptoms come from, is your body's own struggle to metabolize alcohol and sugar. And so wine, sake, and beer have a lot of residual sugar because they're fermented drinks. They're not distilled. Distilled drinks have no sugar left because you've extracted the alcohol from the fermentation. So that's one reason. And that really is true of any spirit. But then shochu is usually diluted to 20 to 25% alcohol. So it's lower proof than whiskeys and gins and vodkas and things like that, which helps. So you can have more glasses without as much alcohol going into your system. And then I think the last reason is because it's single distilled, there are actually fatty acids and amino acids that are captured in the distillation that would be removed from a second spirits run, like happens in virtually all other distillation traditions. So, and there are probably health benefits to that that don't exist in other spirits for that reason. There's actually been high quality clinical research done in Japan that shows that shochu is better for reducing your risk of diabetes and also it's heart healthy and it prevents blood clots. So it actually, you're not supposed to say that an alcohol is healthy, because let's be clear, drinking alcohol is not healthy, but shochu is a healthier alcohol than others.
Right. So, and delicious too.
Yes, it is.
All right. So, so you moved to Fukuoka last year. So what's the reason for that?
So I'd never lived overseas. I didn't really travel internationally other than Canada and Mexico as a child. So I never really had much exposure. I grew up in a suburban neighborhood in Florida, so not exactly a cosmopolitan hub. But I got really interested in Japan through my exposure to food and drinks here. And then, as I said, when I visited, I fell in love with the area. And I really decided, you know, if I'm ever going to do this, I need to do it now. And I was... just Fukuoka has always been my favorite city in Japan ever since I visited for the first time. I mean, there's much stronger shochu culture in other cities in Kyushu. The further south you get, the more shochu obsessed people are. but Fukuoka just has a little bit of everything. You know, it's very convenient. The airport is 6 minutes from the main train station by subway. I now am cycling around Fukuoka to get anywhere, because it'll take me 30 minutes to get anywhere in the city.
Wow.
Or less. And that's just, it's so convenient. And it's got beautiful parks. It's on the water, so I can be near the ocean. And so there's just all sorts of reasons that I wanted to live there. And then I had an opportunity to move there, and I decided to take a sabbatical from my hospital or my university here in New York to go and live in Japan for a year. And I got an opportunity at a university there to do that. and I've now decided I want to stay, at least for a while. So I'm back in New York to try to make that happen. Mm. It's really it's a special place.
Right. Well, good luck. It's a benefit for the whole industry of shochu and Japanese beverage industry. So, yeah, the more you absorb, the more you can spread all over to...
I hope so. And I mean, I've been back... This is my third trip back to New York within the last year, so it's not like I'm completely gone. Mm-hmm. And there's every likelihood that I will be back here at some point.
Right.
Permanently, so...
Mm. Okay, so... All right, so let's talk about your life in Fukuoka. So what do you like about it and what you don't like about it? I mean, a geographical condition that sounds amazing, but...
Sure. So summers are extremely hot and humid. It reminds me of Florida, and I guess having grown up in Florida, I can tolerate it, but it's certainly not comfortable. If I were to mention a minus. But other than that, it really has... It's an extremely convenient place to live.
Mm.
And my Japanese has improved quite a bit living there because I'm forced to. I always learned Japanese from a speaking and listening perspective because I was working in the distillery and I needed to be able to communicate with the other staff. But I never really focused on writing and reading. And now when I go to an izakaya by myself, I need to be able to read the menu.
Ah.
And I need to be able to read road signs and things like that. I was cycling... Very early in my move there, I was cycling out in a rural area, and there was a series of signs, and I didn't know what they meant. And then I got to basically the road was closed because there'd been a mudslide or something. So I would have saved myself, several kilometers of cycling had I realized I needed to take a detour.
Mm, so that's the best way to learn the language.
That's right.
Right. So this is I wanted to discuss it. You opened a cool bar shortly after you moved to Fukuoka, and it's called Yokagan. And I thought it was very stable. It's like, you don't waste any minute. You may make a lot of, experience very meaningful. So what is the concept of Yokagan, and why did you open it?
It was completely opportunistic and random, almost. There's a wine store in Fukuoka called New York Wines.
Mm, interesting, right?
Right. And I was like, why is there a New York wine shop in Fukuoka? And I walked in and I met Brian Dorfman, who's the owner. And he was a New Yorker who actually did audio studio design, much like the space we're in. And he had his own business here. And due to some personal reasons, he needed to stop doing that for a while. And when he came back to New York, his business had dried up. He didn't have any clients. So he was like, and he had just traveled in Japan as part of his... his time off, and he just fell in love with it. And actually, he should tell the story. You should have him on the show.
I'm
going to tell it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to tell it anyway because it's the funniest thing. He was on his flight to Japan, and the stewardess was asking him, and he said it's his first time, and she said, "So where are you visiting?" And he named, Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, the usual places. And she said, "Oh, you should go to Fukuoka. I'm from there. You're going to love it." And so once he got to Japan, he ended up booking a flight down to Fukuoka, and he absolutely fell in love with the city.
Mm.
And so when he got back to New York and he realized it was time for a life change, and he had actually gone to school up in the Finger Lakes area, up in Ithaca. And so he had actually in school met several children of wine producers and other, New York State alcohol producers. And he ended up deciding to import New York State craft alcohols, wine, cider, beer, and spirits to Japan.
Mm.
And he decided to set up shop in Fukuoka, of all places.
It sounds like very coincidental, but it's almost like an accumulated destiny, piece of destiny, right?
That's right. So it turns out we had mutual friends in New York. We actually learned Japanese from the same Japanese teacher here. And we just hit it off. He's just a very easygoing guy, and he's doing what he loves. And so when I visited his shop, we decided to just sit down and talk. And he took me into the back room, and there was a big sort of conference table, and it was, a lot of boxes of wine and spirits and things. And we were talking. I said, "What do you do with this back room?" And he said, "I don't really, it's just sort of a storage room in my office, and sometimes I do events back here." I was like, "Have you ever thought about opening a bar?" And he kind of looked around and he said, that's a great idea. And so I roped Christopher Pellegrini into the project. I'm not sure if he was happy about that or not, but we all chipped in for the renovation. And so I guess to pause, in the States, we have the three-tier system, which means you can't be an alcohol producer, a distributor, and a retailer. And as a retailer, in most states, you can't both sell alcohol to drink on-premise and take away bottles, right? It's easier with wines and with beers, but when spirits enter the equation, it's virtually impossible. So, but in Japan, they don't have anything like that. Mm. Your license is to sell alcohol. And actually, you don't even need, like if you open an izakaya in Japan, you don't need an alcohol license.
I didn't know that.
All you need is a health inspection to make sure that you're not going to make people sick.
Wow.
And like if you have a fire, you're not going to kill all your customers.
Right. Right?
So it's very much about safety, and it's only focused on food preparation. And so anyone can sell alcohol in their shop, and it doesn't matter what kind of alcohol.
Wow.
So it's very, very liberal compared to the States. You know, they didn't have prohibition. Right. And our alcohol laws now are really a legacy of prohibition and organized crime. And so we ended up probably 4 to 6 weeks after that conversation in the back of his liquor shop, we had a functioning bar. But we needed someone to run it because Brian was running the liquor store during the day. And we were extending the hours into the evening, and he didn't want to work from noon to midnight, 7 days a week. So it turned out that a friend of mine from Kyoto, Ryo Uchida, who's from Kagoshima, but he was working in Kyoto. He had just resigned from his izakaya that he was managing, so he had service experience as a manager. And I asked him, would you consider moving to Fukuoka to run our bar? And he's been a godsend. He's bilingual. He lived in Australia for a little while, and he loves shochu. He knows it very, very deeply. He's actually been able to teach Christopher and I and Brian much more about each specific brand than we probably would have been able to figure out on our own. And the customers love him, and he's very happy.
Wow.
So it just all came together very quickly. We started with, I think, about 10 or 12 shochu, and we're up to about 20 brands now. And we're expanding slowly, and we're only serving what I would call craft shochu. So often Japanese customers will come in for the first time, and they'll be looking for some of the main brands, the popular brands. But those popular brands are all, they're very good, but they're mass-produced. And they're not necessarily, they're made with machines, and like they have, you'll go into the distilleries and they have these high-tech computers monitoring temperature, the fermentation and things like that. And you go to a craft distiller and, you know, the Toji, who's the master distiller, he's in there with a thermometer, you know.
Right.
the craftsmanship and the history behind the craft shochu is just really, really fascinating to me. So often when people come in and ask for something, we don't have it. And most people have never, they don't recognize any of our labels.
Wow.
Because it's all very small makers. But because of Ryo's knowledge, he can, if somebody says, oh, do you have Kuro Kirishima, which of course we don't, it's the biggest brand in Japan. He says, no, but I have this sweet potato shochu made with black koji. And, you know, so he can always point them to something similar that's being made by a craftsman rather than by a machine.
So is it centrally located in the city?
It's actually not that convenient. It's on Keyakidori in the Akasaka neighborhood. So it's about a 10 or 12 minute walk from Akasaka station. And there's buses that go directly there, but there's not a convenient subway. But Keyakidori is considered like the Park Avenue of Fukuoka. So when we say New York wines on Keyakidori to anybody in Fukuoka, they're like, oh, wow. It must be, you know, a really special shop. So the store is still called New York Wines. The front is the liquor store, and in the back is the standing bar. It's which is very popular in Fukuoka. They call them kakuuchi, and that's a standing bar inside a liquor store, and they're very, very common in Fukuoka, especially. And So Ryo's taken to calling it the New York zone and the Kyushu zone. So the front of the shop and the back of the shop.
Right. Cool is that.
And we have separate Google pins, which is sort of silly. And it's almost like we never needed to name the bar something other than New York wines.
Mm.
But because it's called Yokoban, which is actually a Kagoshima dialect for a great night out with friends, people understand that it's two separate concepts, and they're very different in their feel. Mm-hmm. And we do have tables in the New York wine side, so you can actually sit and have a drink there. You don't have to stand in the back, but the back is standing only.
It's kind of co-promoting too.
That's right.
Yeah.
And everything's craft. That's the nice thing about it. So all of the New York State products are small, farm distilleries and winemakers and craft beer. And then all of the shochu. And we also have awamori from Okinawa.
Mm.
And actually, we just added Japanese rum to the menu. I think there's four rum makers in Japan. This is the oldest. This is the first company to make Japanese rum.
Mm.
And we haven't visited the distillery yet because we're on an outlying island in Amami in Kagoshima. But when we called them to see if we could get a sample, they said, no, you have to buy a bottle.
Because it's so small.
And the other distilleries just send us samples, you know. And then when we placed an order with them, we had to do it by phone and fax because everybody still faxes in Japan. And then when we got the invoice from them, it was all handwritten. Apparently it's a very old couple that are running it.
Mm.
So I'd love to get down there and visit. And their rum is delicious. But
really?
Yeah, they're very old school and they do things their way and don't really want to be bothered by new customers.
Well, Amami is how far is it from Fukuoka?
It's it's less than a 90-minute flight.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that bad. From Fukuoka it's probably 90 minutes.
Mm.
Last time I flew from Kagoshima.
Okay.
And that was like less than an hour.
Because
Amami is part of Kagoshima Prefecture. But Amami is a cluster of islands situated between Kyushu and Okinawa.
Mm.
It actually, it's part of the Ryukyu Islands,
right,
which is what Okinawa consists of mostly. But Amami was separated from the Ryukyus when the Satsuma Domain, which was the former name of Kagoshima, they invaded Amami and took it over, and they converted it into a sugar plantation.
Mm.
And so the Satsuma domain actually became very rich and powerful because sugar was such a cash crop.
Right.
So they took it from the Ryukyus, which was the old name of Okinawa, and eventually they subjugated the Ryukyu Islands, but they allowed the emperor, the king of Okinawa, to remain in power.
Mm.
But he had to pay pay the Satsuma domain, and the Satsuma domain kindly shared that with the shogun.
Mm.
So that's basically how they got permission to go and invade Okinawa.
Right.
And the other nuance to it that I don't think I really explore in the book is, we haven't talked about the book very much yet, but some of these stories are in there. The Japanese never agreed to pay, what's the term? Basically, an annual fee to the Chinese emperor.
Mm.
The Japanese never agreed to do that, which means that they were prohibited from trading with China. So the Ryukyus and Korea actually became go-between trading posts.
The
Chinese and Japanese could trade indirectly through those countries. And it actually made both of those countries wealthy by facilitating trade between China and Japan.
Right. So that was interesting. So, and I heard Okinawa eventually lost that right to trade in between. I mean, it's kind of their direct trade became more common.
That's right.
So, well, that's interesting. Yeah. So that's why, so going back that the sugar plantation time, that's why they have great, sugar-based product, which is Amami Kokuto.
Kokuto shochu. Yeah. So Kokuto is, Christopher and I have been having a running debate for about 2 or 3 years about what to call Kokuto shochu in English.
Mm.
Because it's a dried, unrefined sugar.
Mm.
So it's not, you can't say sugar cane, you can't say molasses.
Mm.
And if you say brown sugar, my argument is that brown sugar that we get in the States is actually partly refined.
Mm.
Kokuto is not refined. It looks like dark chocolate.
Right.
Right. And it comes in these big blocks because it's dried. So we've decided just to call it Kokuto.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to like make it into something like rice wine or something like that.
That's right. That's right. The, you know, I was calling it black sugar, but then there's other kinds of black sugar from Southeast Asia that are a little bit different than Kokuto. Mm. And we didn't want people to think that it was not native to Japan. Mm. So we've just decided to call it Kokuto.
Sounds good to me. So Kokuto from now on.
That's right.
Let's call it Kokuto.
Yeah, so actually so the Amami Islands after the war were held by the U.S. government. And when the Americans signed the treaty with Japan to return the Amami Islands to Japan, they actually codified the Kokuto Shochu industry in that treaty, as I understand it. So since that time, the only place you can make Kokuto Shochu in Japan is in the Amami Islands.
Mm.
So it really kind of protected their economy
because
they were very, very poor. Mm. I mean, obviously, when they were essentially slaves during the Shogun period, during the Tokugawa, and even after the war, after the modernization of Japan, they still remained a very, very poor cluster of islands. And they're still one of the poorest areas of Japan.
Mm.
But with 28 distilleries all making Kokuto Shochu, it's helped support their economy. Mm.
And now rum, hopefully.
That's right.
Right. Yes, I really wish I could try that too. So, yeah, hopefully. Are they big, really like a small, very small production?
They're extremely small as far as we can tell. And what's funny is everything comes in shochu bottles, but it's labeled rum. So it's 40% alcohol. I'm very curious about how they make it because you can taste the Kokuto.
Mm.
So it's certainly made from Kokuto, but then the question is, are they actually still using koji and making shochu but calling it rum, which they could do.
Interesting. Wow, there's so many like undiscovered regulational like those holes and magics.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, maybe next time you can just come back and talk about Japanese cocktail and rum.
Sure. I should have brought a bottle, but
next time. So you said, you know, the charm of shochu is a lot of the distilleries are cracked, but what's the percentage? How craft are they right now?
That's a really difficult question to answer. There are around, as I understand it, there are about 800 or so shochu licenses that are currently held. It may be a little bit more than that. A lot of them aren't actively producing. Mm. I think there are probably around 400 to 450 active producers throughout Japan, most of them concentrated in Kyushu. And it's you never know, unless you visit, how they make it, right? And there are actually, there's several distilleries that don't have distilleries. They hire other distilleries to contract to distill their products, and then they sell it under their own label.
Mm.
Now they might have had distilleries in the past, but for whatever reason they've closed. But they continue to sell the brand through the contract production.
Right.
So you never know until you go to the distillery whether or not it exists.
Right.
But that's rare. Most distilleries do have their own facilities. It's really hard to guess how many are large facilities versus not, because as I said, I really, really love the craftsmanship. So those are the distilleries I try to visit. And you'll learn from talking to if you meet the makers at a trade show or something, you'll learn a bit about their production and that sort of thing and get a sense of how crafty they are.
Mm.
Most shochu is made as mass-produced product, just because the volumes that these large factories can make is so much higher than what a craftsman can make.
So that out of 400 plus active distilleries, may probably more than half of it is produced by like 10% of the distilleries or something like that.
I would say 80% of it's made by 10% of the distilleries. You have probably 7 or 8 very large companies that dominate the market, and then you have all these very small family-run distilleries. And just to give you a sense of scale, the new Kirishima distillery, they just opened a new facility to increase production of Kuro Kirishima, which, as I said, is the most popular brand in Japan. If it wasn't lost in translation, they're now producing 400,000 liters of shochu a day.
A day?
A day.
Wow.
And they make it all year round. The distillery where I work, they make about 40,000 liters of raw distillate a year.
Wow.
So 10% of Kirishima's annual, 10% of Kirishima's daily production, they make annually.
Wow. Wow. Well, in a way, we need those big producers, right, to familiarize people with shochu, but then the small producers could be pressured, but they need them too. So
that's like, right. It really is symbiotic, and I think that fortunately the large producers and small producers realize this, and they do work together.
Right.
And of course you have personalities and there's rivalries and people who don't like each other and that kind of thing. And
right.
But for the most part, you'll find, especially the small producers will never say anything bad about the large producers, and the large producers won't say anything bad about the small producers.
Mm.
It's more the same size producers that tend to,
right.
to you know, be fighting for market share and trying to outdo each other.
Right. Well, I hope that small producers can maybe add the value, increase the price because being, craft and hopefully more organic and those, added value found in small producers, then they can survive with additional income.
Right? Yes, and I think that's what happens once your brand becomes popular. Even if you can't produce more than you're already making, you can start to raise the price. But shochu is so cheap in Japan. It's extremely affordable. So a bottle, standard, what we would think of as a standard-sized bottle here in the States would sell for about, for a mass-produced brand, would probably be 700 to 900 yen in a convenience store.
Mm.
A very, very fine craft shochu that's very hard to get with the same alcohol percentage would be about 1200 or 1300 yen.
Wow.
So it's only $3 or $4 more.
Mm.
The premium is not that high.
Right.
Now, there are some very, very famous producers that sell very limited quantities, and they'll actually just auction their bottles or... they'll do lotteries.
Mm.
And so they might sell those bottles for up to 3,000 yen, so about $30 or so.
Right.
But that's still very, very cheap compared to like a scotch or a,
right.
Mezcal or that sort of thing.
Right. So, yeah, but it sounds like the direction of the industry is good now.
I think they're struggling. The drinking in Japan is decreasing over time. The population is aging and shrinking. So they currently have negative population growth,
right.
So population decline. And the older, as people get older, they don't drink as much.
Mm.
And then also the younger generation's not drinking as much. Shochu had a big boom in the early 2000s, and now it's really been fading. And yet everything's fading, all of the alcohol sales in Japan, except for whiskey.
Right.
Japanese whiskey is now extremely popular all
over
the world.
That's funny, though. They kind of tanked and came back for marketing or quality.
That's right. Yeah. It all goes in waves, and I do think the shochu makers will be fine. There were 2 years ago, there were 120 active distilleries in Kagoshima.
Mm.
And now there are, I believe, 113. So 7 of them have closed just in the last 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So the industry is struggling, and they're trying to find ways to survive.
Mm.
I do think export hopefully will become part of that more than it is currently.
Mm.
Most shochu is consumed in Japan.
Right. Well, I spoke to one of those major producers of alcoholic beverages in Japan, and he said, so gin and vodka has only one, I think like less than 3% of market share because everybody drinks shochu instead of other distilled, types of alcohol. So... yeah, that's interesting. I hope shochu is going to stay solid and it's healthier. So that's what I hope.
Yes. And I've done the math, and I think shochu, if shochu could reach 1% of the US spirits market, that would increase increase export by 40-fold.
Mm.
That's how little shochu is consumed in America.
Wow.
So it'd be a huge, huge boon to the shochu industry if we could just convince 1% of American spirits drinkers to switch to shochu.
It's easy once they know.
Let's hope so.
We rely on you, Stephen. All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Stephen's exciting new book, The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Koin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Koin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit koin.com.
Are you enjoying this show? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Luke Griffin, and I'm the host of Bushwick Podcast. Each week, we share the remarkable stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in Bushwick, a special Brooklyn neighborhood that's changing faster by the day. You can find Bushwick Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Stephen Lyman, who is the leading expert of shochu and the author of The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. He's visiting from Fukuoka, Japan, where he lives now. So now let's talk about your new book. So the title is The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks, and it's not a just guide. So you covered everything from the history to actual, you know, definition of the drinks, but also the cultural connotations of each subject. I really enjoyed reading it. So it's like, it's a guidebook, but it's beyond. It's like a good read.
Thank you.
Yeah. So why did you write the book?
So when I, as a child, actually, when I realized I wasn't going, probably in high school, I realized I wasn't going to be a Major League Baseball player. I had to find a new dream. And my dream was actually to become an author.
Mm.
The two things I want to do is become a professor and become an author. And I've been a professor now for close to 20 years.
Wow.
And as a professor, I write scientific manuscripts. So I could do writing, but it's very technical. Not a lot of people read them, other than people in my field.
Mm.
But at least I could do some writing. And I got to write some book chapters as part of that. And then through Shochu, I started my website, and I was writing a lot of content for that, and eventually was asked to write some articles for different trade publications and things like that in the alcohol world. And then, but I always wanted to write a book, and I thought it would be a Shochu book. Obviously, that's my main area of interest in Japanese alcohol. But an opportunity arose to write a when I pitched the Shochu book to the publisher, which is Tuttle. Tuttle is an international publisher, primarily of Asian-focused literature. When I pitched the Shochu book to them, the editor said, you know, maybe you can write that in the future, but we're not sure that the market's ready for it. Christopher's, the Shochu Handbook remains the only English-language Shochu-focused book. I do think there's an opportunity for another Shochu book, but they said, well, why don't you just write about all Japanese alcohol? We could use that sort of thing. And I had become friendly with the author of a book that was called Drinking Japan. Mm. It's a little pocket guide it serves as a travel guide for drinkers who are visiting Japan. And I asked him, you know, whether or not he would be interested in writing with me. And he's actually moved back to the UK. He was a journalist in Tokyo at the time he wrote the book, but then he ended up moving back to the UK. And now he actually works in healthcare, so he does very similar work to what I do. And he said, you know, I'm not really in a position to, you know, travel around and visit breweries and distilleries and bars and things like that. But what he did is he allowed me to use all of his source material from his original book. So a lot of the research and history and things like that, he had a very, very competent translator who had helped him with a lot of that original research. And so I actually have a stack of notebooks from him in my apartment here. And then he gave me about 20,000 photos that he had taken for the original book. And then I had to go and do my own photography once we got the deal. And so I ended up taking all of his source material and turning it into this. And so his contribution was the research.
Mm.
Right. And but it was incredibly helpful. I don't think I could have done what I did without without.
Well,
that
I was very impressed how detailed, and I could see that you are such a researcher that it's like all those, you know, facts and deep insight into what happened, and you know, those are really, I think, it's your work too. But it's crazy how like this. How many pages is the book?
I'm not even sure.
It's so much in there.
Let's see, 159 total pages? 160.
Okay.
But it's coffee table size, right? It's actually quite a bit of material. Mm. A friend of mine who just I met last night here in New York, I gave him a copy. You know, for he actually designed the Kanpai website for me. So I gave him a copy of the book, and he was leafing through, and he goes, "This is like a textbook." I was like, "What do you expect when a professor writes a book?"
Yeah, well, it can be for the facts, and but you read through like you can't stop. It's a perfect book. And to read over a glass of shochu or anything sake. Or, by the way, what do you cover in the book?
Okay, so what I decided to do is split the book into two parts. It really has a third part, which I'll talk about. But the first part is washu, so Japanese alcohol traditions. Mm. And that's, of course, sake, shochu, awamori from Okinawa, and umeshu and other fruit liqueurs. Mm. So umeshu is often called plum wine, which is, it's not really a wine because the plums themselves don't contribute any of, they're not fermented in the alcohol. They're there to add flavor to usually a shochu base. Mm, so they take a clear spirit and then they age the plums with some sugar in it. And but then the Japanese do that with all kinds of fruits and even with other herbs and things like that. The weirdest one, of course, is habushu, which is habu is a pit viper.
Right.
And so in Okinawa, they have this tradition of essentially drowning a pit viper in awamori and leaving it. And what it does is apparently, and I don't proclaim to be an expert at all, the venom and that sort of thing leaks out of the viper, but it's so diluted in the liquid that it becomes harmless, or at least it's not lethal.
Right.
And but apparently that venom is invigorating.
Mm.
And so it's almost like a Chinese medicine.
Right.
Right. And it tastes horrible.
Mm.
But it actually is a thing in Japan.
Right. So this is supposed to be giving you energy or maybe like homeopathic effects.
That's right. I think it's probably placebo, but I do feel, I'm not sure though, because the first time I ever tried it was in Tokyo. I was out drinking with my friends and we just happened into we were in Golden Guy, you know,
in Shinjuku,
and sort of on a dare, I tried it, and I was buzzing. It's like I had a triple espresso at 2 in the morning. So I think there may be some truth to the invigoration part of it, but I don't really know what the chemical properties are.
Wow, I don't think I've tried that. I've seen it, but I've never tried that. Yeah. So
try with caution, I think.
Okay.
so that was an aside, but so that's the umeshu and fruit liqueurs chapter, but I do get into kajitsushu?
Kajitsu, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so, fruits.
Oh, that's fruits, and then there's another one. Sorry, I should have refreshed my memory. Because I do also touch on the medicinal alcohols, so there's the yakushu. Yeah, so that's more herbs and things. It's much more like the digestifs from Europe.
Mm.
You know, it sometimes can be bitter, or you know, have like what's the green chartreuse, for example, has something like 200 organic, you know, plants and herbs and things in it, and the yakushu has that. Style, and it's not for everybody, but it's another kind of alcohol that's produced in Japan. Right. So that's the first half is washu. The second half is yoshu. So yoshu is Western alcohol, so from outside of Japan, but that are now made in Japan. And all of these really arose after Commodore Perry sailed his black sheeps into Edo Bay and opened Japan. And so it's a beer, wine, whiskey, and then cocktails. So all three of those, so wine, whiskey, and beer all started to be produced in Japan after the 1850s.
Right.
And the Japanese have been growing grapes as an exotic food for centuries, but they never made wine from it.
Mm.
And they really didn't know how. So very early on, they were using sake making equipment to try to make wine. And it wasn't very good, apparently.
Mm.
none of it exists anymore, of course, because that was, you know,
right. 150
years ago. So they started sending young men over to France to learn how to make wine. And it was then that they were able to come back and start a real wine industry. But the most, probably the best Japanese winemaker didn't make wine in Japan. He made wine in California. And he was actually the son of a samurai, and he was sent out of Japan illegally, along with 17 other students. They took the 18 brightest children from Kagoshima. Actually, I think there might have been 15 students and 4 chaperones. He was one of the brightest students, and they were all sons of samurai. And they were sent to England to study, because the Satsuma domain, they realized that they needed to modernize. They had a brief skirmish with the English. And the English, like, essentially burned down Kagoshima City. And so, but rather than remain enemies of the English, they became friendly, and the English cooperated and helped them sneak these children out of the country. And they all went to England to study. And of those children, 14 of them came back to Japan. One opened Sapporo Beer. One started the first stock exchange. One was the first minister of education. One of them started a university. So they all came back, and they were very successful. Two exceptions. Well, he was successful. So the winemaker is Kanai Nagasawa. He ended up at Cornell University. He was the first Asian student to study at Cornell in New York. And then he ended up joining a cult. But his job at the cult was to make wine.
Wow.
On their New York State property. But he and the cult leader realized that you could make better wine in California. So they moved to Santa Rosa, California, established a new commune. And then when the cult leader retired, Nagasawa became, nominally he became the cult leader, but he didn't really care about the cult. He just cared about making wine.
Wow.
So his winery actually ended up being the largest winery in California. And he was the first California wine to export to Europe.
I didn't know anything about that.
And unfortunately, because of Prohibition, it fell apart. And he died a year after Prohibition ended. But even during Prohibition, he was very clever. He would sell grape juice. And on the label, it would very clearly explain how to make sure it didn't turn into wine. So people could make their own wine at home.
Wow. So is he in the book?
He is, yeah.
Okay. So, well, I really have to read through the whole pages. So when is it coming out officially?
Officially, it's October 1st in the U.S. I've asked the publisher to let me know when it'll come out in Japan and in Europe and Canada. It is available for pre-order on Amazon, and pre-order helps. So please consider pre-ordering the book.
So listeners, it's The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks by Stephen Lyman from Taro.
That's right. And my co-author, Chris Bunting. Let's not forget Chris and his valuable contribution.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. And what was the biggest challenge in writing the book? Of course you had Chris' help, but anything you discovered or you had a hard time understanding?
I think that's a great question. Probably the most challenging part of it, I mean, I've been writing for a long time, so I didn't have writer's block or anything like that. I could just sit down and write. But probably the hardest part was getting all the photography organized.
Oh.
Because it's a very colorful book. There's lots of pictures. And I had a lot of photos from my trips. But the thing is when you're printing photos, you need very high resolution photos. So things from iPhones don't work. As high res as the new iPhones are, it's still not good enough for print publication usually, unless you're just putting a very small picture if you're just printing a small picture. So the guide ended up organizing all the photos was the biggest challenge. So I had Christopher's photos, and then I had ended up taking thousands myself. And then I basically, when I realized there were gaps, I had to use, I just basically on my social network through Twitter and Facebook, I just reached out and asked if anybody had high resolution photos that they'd taken on trips to Japan. And I had a few people ended up sending me some great, great photography that ended up in the book.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's nice. That's a very collaborative efforts. All right. So, did you interview a lot of people? to...
I did, and I visited a lot of breweries and distilleries. I got tremendous help from the producers as far as just sharing their knowledge, and I learned so much. And there's actually information on the sake chapter that I don't think has ever been in English before, which I was a little bit nervous writing about sake because there's so many great sake books already from John Gauntner. Philip Harper's written, you know, really interesting things. There's just great sake writing already. So that was probably the chapter I was most nervous about writing. I ended up having several sake experts read through it and make sure I wasn't making a fool of myself. And John actually gave me some, I've never met him, but we had an email exchange. And he gave me some great advice about how to tweak some of it. I was a little loose with my description of koji. And I think it's completely fair. It's a very difficult topic to explain in English. And there's actually a Sake on Air podcast. Maybe I'm not supposed to mention competing podcast, but their koji episode.
No, we are friends, so we're collaborative. Yeah,
good. Their koji episode very recently, like they explained things that I still didn't know about koji, even though I've been working with it for 7 years now. And so the sake chapter ended up coming together really nicely. And actually, there was a toji master brewer from Nara, who just gave me amazing information. He sat down with me for, I went to visit his brewery, but we spent about 10 minutes in the brewery and about 3 hours talking. And he was drawing me diagrams and pictures and, explaining the entire history of Nara sake, because that's where sake actually, the modern style was developed in Nara by Buddhist priests. And he just gave me a wealth of information, which was so much fun.
So sounds like a process. Well, it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
I didn't write it, but I feel so proud of it. But your process of writing the book must be really precious, right?
It was a special experience, and it's something I've always wanted to do. Right? And now that I've done it, I hope I can do it again.
So the next one is shochu.
Maybe.
Or something else.
Well, the publisher has talked to me about an izakaya guide. And then they've also talked to me about a Kyushu guide. And so I'm not exactly sure what my next book will be, but I have a feeling it'll be with Tattle.
That sounds great. All right. So, so good luck, and please keep us posted. And where can we find your updates online?
So my website is kampai.us. You can spell it K-A-M-P-A-I or K-A-N-P-A-I. That doesn't have a lot of new information on it, but it will soon. On Instagram and Twitter, I am at shochu_danji.
Danji is a man.
It's like a Kyushu danji is like a very stubborn.
Yep, that was my dad.
But I call myself shochu danji because I'm really stubborn about shochu. I'm very picky. So, and then I'm on Facebook, and I have a Facebook group, Kampai, which people are welcome to join. Also, Japanese shochu page on Facebook is me as well. So there's lots of ways to find me on social media.
Right. All right. So very exciting. So hopefully I'll see you again in the studio.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or show suggestions for show topics or with guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi,
I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.